From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made about a year ago when the Democrat and Chronicle launched an initiative that they call Time to Educate. 12 months ago, there were discussions about all kinds of possible reforms, but no real momentum for change. And now as the initiative passes the one-year mark, senior engagement editor Julie Phillip believes it has helped spark some of the most serious discussions for change in Rochester schools. Leading the list is the proposal for a state takeover of the school board. The Democrat and Chronicle is reflecting on what it learned in year one of the initiative, but to be fair, it's not like the paper only started reporting on education last year. They've always offered some of the most important coverage of the RCSD in our community, right alongside our colleagues here at WXXI in City, of course. So this hour, we discuss what they've learned in the last year and what they hope to achieve going into year two. Julie Phillip is the senior engagement editor for the Democrat and Chronicle. Welcome back. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
In Thanks, your Evan. Old digs.
Yes.
Well, you're very familiar with WXXI. Nice to have Michael Killian here with us in studio, the executive editor for the Democrat and Chronicle. Since when? How new are you? I kept calling you new. Are you new?
I've been here less than 6 months. I'm a Fairport native. I haven't lived here in 34 years, so kind of a new.
New-ish, but boy, yes. It's sort of offensive that this is my first time seeing you here, not just because I should have reached out harder. So it's nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Our thanks to Justin Murphy, who's here, the education reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle. Welcome, Justin.
Hi, Evan.
And Eric O'Brien is a columnist for the Democrat and Chronicle as well. Eric, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Julie, a year ago you launched with, what I want to do is sort of reset what the goal was and talk about what you've seen in the last year, and then we'll kind of broaden out here. Take me back a year. What was the goal?
The goal was to take a look at the way that we were reporting and editorializing on education in our community, because there is a lot of frustration in our newsroom that we had been doing it for decades but having very little impact in the community. There was no reform movement. We kept doing the same things over and over again. And it seemed like the community was just sort of shrugging every time we announced that there was another closing school or another one that didn't come anywhere near where it should be in terms of graduation or test scores. So we started aligning efforts, and I know we talked about this right here on your show, between our journalist side and our editorial side, so that we did solutions-based reporting. We wanted to go out into the community and across the nation looking for things that were working in other communities and figuring out how we could implement them here. And then the editorial side of that would be almost become an advocate for those things, helping the community find ways to implement them. So that was the original intent.
You comfortable enough, Justin, that we've kept it separate on the editorial and reporting side?
We're doing okay so far.
It's important, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. And so we're going to talk about some of the reporting that Justin, some of the work that Eric has done and their colleagues, because obviously there's a lot happening right now in Rochester City Schools. But Julie, you couldn't have envisioned a year ago that we'd be sitting here with one of the most significant and frankly, radical reforms really on the table, which is a state takeover of the school board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the bigger underlying difference between now and 1 year ago is all those things that we were talking about before were really pointing at the school district, the problems that they were having, that the superintendent was having, or the board was having, or charter schools were having. It was really looking at a broken system and asking the broken system to fix itself. We now have a really robust conversation happening among leaders from the state and the city and the county. So the leaders are pointing at each other to come up with ways to fix a broken system rather than asking the system to do it.
And the paper has come out and said?
The paper is...
The editorial department has said?
The editorial board has backed the idea of an appointed board. And the reasoning behind that, if I could kind of sum up everybody, it was a long discussion, but before we started Time to Educate, Fran Weisberg was stepping down from United Way, and we were talking, the board met with her, and we said, you know, why aren't people mad? Like, why aren't people really rallying to do something about education? And she said, because nothing's on the table. There's nothing for them to see. And to want and to go for and to talk about and to discuss. Nobody was taking the lead in terms of putting solutions out there. And so we see this, what Warren is proposing and others have backed, is something's on the table now for really robust discussion and really making a dramatic change, because the tinkering around the edges we've been doing and doing and doing, and it doesn't have any impact. So that's the reasoning behind that.
We'll come back to that theme in a second. I want to ask Michael Killian how you think this initiative sort of ties into the work that maybe newspapers should be doing in communities.
Thank you. Yes. As we know, the local news industry is in peril nationwide. And we have to not only be relevant, we have to be impactful, we have to be leaders. And if you think of great newspapers of 100 years ago, they were often crusading, right, for better cities, for better lives, for residents. And in a modern sense, that's what we have to be today.
How do you feel about the state of this industry and that? I'm just going to be blunt here, because I have been an unabashed supporter of print. I think it's vital to the fabric of this country. And, you know, in a conversation with Tom Hamburger, who's an investigative reporter with the Washington Post earlier this week, he said, look, with the Post, with the New York Times, it's a different story than it is in regional, smaller city newspapers. And he's very concerned about the future of the industry. How concerned should we be about the future of print in Rochester?
I think the future of local news everywhere, including Rochester, should be a concern to everyone. The economic model, which made local newspapers robust for most of the 20th century, is in tatters for a range of reasons. Digital technology, changes in audience behavior, the rise of social media, and everything else that happens on our phones every day. And many working age adults do not make a daily appointment with local news anymore. So there's consequences to that, economically and civically. And so that's something we're working through and putting front and center. And with this group here in the room and everybody back over at our offices, it's really about how do we have an impact? How do we drive conversations in meaningful ways so that people realize that they're missing out if they're not absorbing what the DNC is offering?
In 1 year, in 5 years, in 10 years, what I want to see is a continuing daily print edition. I want to see it forever. And, you know, back in the late 90s, there were all these prognostications that, well, by 2005, we won't see print anymore. And happily, those were wrong. But here we are now. We're seeing some scale back the print runs. Some are cutting print entirely. If we're going to see print continue in Rochester, what has to happen, Michael?
First, you need to do everything I just talked about, that the reporting is strong enough, relevant enough, that people are willing to pay for it, right, support it, and see it as meaningful to their lives, to the communities, to their neighborhoods, to people they care about. And then the second aspect is what happens with the economic model, much as what outside of my hands or your hands is ultimately what's supporting it. And the audience will decide. I mean, any of us who have 18-year-olds in our lives knows that print is not part of their lives and not likely to be. So by the time they're my age, I don't think print's going to exist. Should it exist for the duration of the 2020s at least? I believe that it should and that it will.
Okay. I think that's a fair and direct comment, because when Michael talks about having the reporting that people decide is worth paying for, I mean, goodness gracious, look at the people you have at the table. This takes nothing away, by the way, from my colleagues at XXI or City. Justin Murphy, Eric Bryant, Gary Craig, Steve Orr, Megan McDermott. I mean, these are vital people in our community. It is bad news if somehow we don't have them working in journalism. They're already doing great work, and it's hard to get people to pay for content, which is a whole other thing here. I mean, that's a cultural shift that I wish we could kind of pull back the reins from. We're all working on figuring out how to do that, I guess. Fair?
Oh, fair. You know, if we could all go back to 1995 and have people pay for news then, we'd likely be in much better shape. And, you know, and because we didn't, it's hard to break those habits. There's an entire generation that's grown up getting its news for quote-unquote free. Nothing is free. Nothing of value is free. Right?
Those fools in 1995. Only the Wall Street Journal put up a paywall. Well, let's get back to the reason we're here. And I want to put it to Julie in a way that caught my attention, to the point where next week we're going to have a discussion on this program about a piece in The Atlantic right now. And it's about public schools. Nick Hanauer is a billionaire who was in venture capital, and he is now one of the consistent voices calling for economic equality. Hanauer constantly says that the politics and the economy protect people like him, rich white guys with a lot of money and a lot of power. And he is essentially what we would call a traitor to his own class. He wants higher minimum wages. He wants a new economic system. But he wrote a piece for The Atlantic this week, and I want to quote from what he says here. He writes, "Long ago, I was captivated by a seductively intuitive idea, one many of my wealthy friends still subscribe to, that both poverty and rising inequality are largely consequences of America's failing education system. Fix that, I believed, and we could cure much of what ails America. This belief system, which I have come to think of as educationism, is grounded in a familiar story about cause and effect. Once upon a time, America created a public education system that was the envy of the modern world. But then, sometime around the 1970s, America lost its way. We allowed our schools to crumble and our test scores and graduation rates to fall. As America's public school system foundered, so did the earning power of the American middle class. But after decades of organizing and giving, I have come to the uncomfortable conclusion that I was wrong. What I've realized is that educationism is tragically misguided. American workers are struggling in large part because they are underpaid, and they are underpaid because 40 years of trickle-down policies have rigged the economy in favor of wealthy people like me. Most American workers at all levels of educational attainment have seen little, if any, wage growth since 2000. To be clear, we should do everything we can to improve our public schools, but our education system can't compensate for the ways our economic system is failing Americans. Even the most thoughtful and well-intentioned school reform program can't improve educational outcomes if it ignores the single greatest driver of student achievement, household income." End quote. That's from Nick Hanauer this week in The Atlantic. And what that says to me is, you can reform all you want. You can radically reform. And it's not going to work without economic change. So I don't mean to undermine the whole premise here, but I suspect you disagree with some of this. What do you think?
Well, he's a very smart man, I'm sure. Probably smarter than I am. But what we discovered that it isn't we have to fix this before we do that, or we have to fix this before we can fix that. The editorial board in our discussions and with our expert advisory committee on this have really learned that it's all connected, that you can't fix education without working on housing. You can't fix education without working on jobs. You can't fix education without working on transportation. You can't fix education without working with other systems. It's not a system over here. Oh, let's get everybody a job and then we'll fix education, which sounds like what he's saying. I think what he's saying is
you fix poverty and you fix schools.
Well, okay. I don't think that that's working in Rochester to fix poverty first and then go to education. It's really you've got to look at all of the systems as a whole.
Okay. Erica Bryan, how do you feel about what he says there about inequality and its impact on education?
Well, I would totally agree. I believe that, I'm working on a piece about homeless students in Rochester and sort of the mechanisms that are being set up to mediate the traumatic effect of homelessness. And so as I'm reporting this, it's like, okay, they're doing all of these sort of interventions and they have different interventions in New York City. But the problem is that there are just a skyrocketing number of children who are experiencing homelessness. And in New York City, it's astounding. It's hundreds of, it's 142,000 children will experience homelessness in this school year. And to expect the school system to sort of fix that is you know, it's hard to... It's not realistic. And so I believe, of course, like we have to try. I mean, the education system in Rochester, without a doubt, could be better and should be better. And there are many things that we ought to fix. However, the underlying cause of the problems is the just highly concentrated extreme poverty. And I remember Bulgan Vargas used to say something. I was at a talk or something, and somebody was saying, oh, blame the parents, it's the parents' fault because they're not reading to the students, they don't care about education, et cetera, et cetera. And he stood up for his parents, and he's like, no, my parents are the parents who are cleaning the hospital beds. Like, my parents are the parents who are working three jobs. My parents are the parents who don't have any control over their schedules, who don't have any control over healthcare, who don't have any control over, who are sort of at the bottom of the economic scale. And then to expect them to be able to provide the kinds of homes that facilitate good education is unrealistic and crazy. So you do have to fix the economic problems first. And then we can try to do things that will help, you know, the kids who are suffering under these bad conditions. But until you fix the things that he's talking about, yeah, I mean, I don't think you're going to see that much of an improvement.
Okay. Justin Murphy has been doing reporting on a number of different things happening in the Rochester City School District that I think talk about this solutions-based, these questions. So let's talk about some of that. And in particular, I want to hit a couple of big ones, which is, what's going on at East? And I also want to talk about something that's invoked constantly, and it's happened throughout this the school board election season here on Connections. People talk about community schools and the confusion over what that really means. Let's start with East High School, because, well, what's going on there? There's a renewed plan for another 5 years there?
Well, actually, Evan, let me start with the community schools,
because
I think that ties in nicely to the point Julie made, which is the way that systems are connected and the difficulty of teasing them apart. I think that what you see with community schools is kind of an attempt to replicate that system using the school as a nexus. So School 17, which is the one that we're usually talking about, has the educational component, of course. It also has a healthcare component. A lot of times you'll see schools trying to get involved in either adult education, which RCSD has, or trying to provide all different sorts of ancillary services to families, helping connect them with housing, that sort of thing. So, you know, that's the kind of work that we all agree should be getting done somehow, and it's just sort of been, I would say, hoisted on the education system as opposed to any other entity that might be better off coordinating that. One of the members of our Time to Educate advisory panel, Kara Finnegan, a professor at the University of Rochester, that's a really big point for her. She's saying that it's not a coincidence that the problems in education, and in particular who they affect, are mirrored in housing and in transportation policy and health and all that. So you need to zoom back out to a regional, some sort of at least metro level, to address all of that stuff holistically.
We talk about community schools, though, and a lot of people will go, well, I think I know what that is.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
So, you know, in general, it's the school that gives us all the warm, fuzzy feeling where we walk down the street and say hi to Mrs. Jones on her porch and, you know, can come home for lunch and all of that. Generally speaking, what they're the idea is a school that not only has the academics, but has other stuff embedded in it. So we have a lot of really neat sites in Rochester, including 17, where there's a rec center attached, maybe there's a library attached, and then they'll come in with medical services and other things. And crucially, I think the point that sort of gets you a cut above is not only that all of those things exist on the same plot of land, but that they're coordinated in some way. So that has been one of the successful parts in Rochester. The other important thing is when we talk about a community school, presumably we're talking about a geographical community, the couple of blocks around the school in every direction where kids are going. And that is a good example of a place where the sort of theoretical appreciation of this idea has not made a lot of traction, practically speaking. The school district has complained for years and years that it can't bus kids a mile down the road. You can only get state funding for busing if it's a mile and a half, which is why there are every single day literally thousands of kids who are getting on a bus, going past the school that's closest to them into another one on the opposite side of town, not because it's any better, not because they particularly want to be there, but because if you have a seven-year-old, you can't expect them to walk a mile and a quarter to school in the morning in the winter in Rochester. So that's an example of, like, when we think through the implication, we'll get to this at East too, when you think through the implications of some of these policies, it always ends up being the wider context of how we educate kids needs to change very much, whether it's something as simple as busing locally or what we mean when we say having embedded community services and having some meaningful public financial support for that.
But here's an email from a listener already. And by the way, it's good that we're getting email. Connections at WXXI.org, or as we talk about city schools and the initiative from the Democrat and Chronicle that is now moving into its second year, you can call the program 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. They call it Time to Educate. And two emails from two different Alexes. The first one says, wait, I thought we were talking about neighborhood schools, community schools, neighborhood schools.
Yeah, generally speaking, I think the rough difference is the neighborhood school refers to a student placement policy where kids tend to go to the school that's close to their
closest
house.
Closest to them, yeah.
Community school takes that and builds on it with embedded services in the building.
Okay, so I hope that clears that up, Alex. And as we continue the discussion, Julie, we talked about what you wanted to set out to do a year ago. What's the goal in year two now?
Well, it ties right in with what we're talking about now. You know, we did find Justin and Erica and others found some great solutions, programmatic in nature, that are working both right here already and in other cities, Indianapolis, Windsor, and Erica went to New York City. But what it comes down to at the end of the day, that those are not sustainable without these wider system considerations. So in year two, that will be one of our focuses. Again, the editorial board thinking behind having a state-appointed board is that these don't necessarily need to be people from Albany. They can be people from Rochester, but that they have a state-level connection, because a lot of the changes, like the busing thing, would have to be done at the state level. So there has to be some more accountability on the state. So that's going to be one focus this year. So looking less at the individual solutions and more at some of these systems that are broken, quite frankly. And then the second emphasis will be on parent engagement. That is a piece that is really critical. Nobody's really cracked it. A lot of people have tried. And we think we've come up with a few ways to do that we'll be rolling out.
Well, can you break a little news here? Because this would be very impactful. If you could. And I don't mean to be flippant here, because I think there have been some rough moments where people, probably people like me, people of privilege, just go, well, the parents don't care. The parents aren't involved. I'm sure in some cases we could have parents who care a lot more or can do better. But we also had, you know, Kamala Harris in 2010 was joking that when she was AG of California, they were going to put parents in jail if their kids didn't show up at school. Well, some of these parents are working multiple jobs, are single parents, single mothers, and multiple kids. It's complicated. The notion of just getting parents to quote-unquote care is important, but it's probably also easily misunderstood. So what are you mm-hmm, working mm-hmm. on? I mean, can you... You're waiting to roll this out, I suspect, but you could roll out one.
Yeah, we're waiting to roll it out. But I can tell you that this morning I was at School 9, Boys Academy, with four moms, all very, very engaged in their children's education, all very excited because School 9 had been in receivership for 3 years, just got out. But now that it's out, they're pulling back the things that were working for their children. And the mothers are terrified of the fact that their kids, for instance, they found out last week, the summer program that they go out to Brockport and they see colleges and they learn science and math and they've been going there for the last 2 years, they found out last week that program's no longer funded. So 2 weeks, well, I don't know, 2 weeks before school gets out, they suddenly have no program for their boys. And they work two or three jobs. And so they're scrambling to find something to do that's productive with their children. And they're even offering, you know, do you know where in the district we can go and offer our help? We could hold fundraisers. We could do bake sales. They don't even know where to begin to fix the problem. But they care very deeply about their sons and their sons' education. So it's getting their stories out there is how we're going to do it, and not just bits and pieces. We're going to do it in force.
And I think I saw Erica flinch a little when we talked about parent involvement. Do people tend to sort of misunderstand or overly judge, you know, what's going on in the city of Rochester?
Well, I was flinching because I can't believe that they took that program away 2 weeks before school starts. I mean, this is the kind of thing that we see all the time. You fix a problem, and then you remove the supports and the money that fixed it, and then you act surprised when the school's back in receivership in 2 years. So that's why I flinched. So, but you asked me about parent involvement, and yeah, I mean, I get that all the time. Anytime I write an article about a school with high poverty or school, you know, where there's struggling things, it was, well, it's the parents' fault. We have to blame the parents. You should write a column blaming the parents, you know, parents, whatever. And I think it's very, very rare to have a parent that doesn't care about their children. Sure, there's some sociopaths in the world, whatever, but that's extremely rare. What's more, very much more common is that, you know, you have parents who just, life has beaten them up really badly. So the lady I'm writing about in the homeless story that I'm working on, she was in foster care. She moved 7 times before she was 12, and then as she was in like 6 foster care placements. So now she has 2 children of her own. Like, she's not really equipped to understand the how to provide a stable home because you never experienced a stable home. So when you have that kind of situation, you don't say she doesn't care about her kids. Is that, you know, it's just extreme poverty beats people up. Like it beats you up. And I know from myself, I have three children. And when I'm stressed out about my like small problems, I don't, you know, I'm not as good about reading to them, or I'm not as good about, you know, doing things. So I can't even imagine if I was trying to deal with eviction, if I was trying to deal with trying to string together, you know, the hours of like a couple different minimum wage jobs, if I was trying to like find childcare at the last minute because my schedule doesn't have to get put up by law, you know. Those kind of things. Like, I think that people have to understand the circumstances that the parents are in. And sure, there's some, you can always find somebody that's, it's their fault and they should just act better. But the majority of the people are not like that.
We're talking about the Democrat and Chronicles initiative, Time to Educate. And before we go to break, I'll ask Michael Killian, you know, for the old school purists who just see, you know, gumshoe reporting, put it out there, let the community decide. This is a newspaper that's taking a much more active role, and I suspect that's just part of the new landscape of what you know media organizations have to do now, right?
There's no question. What happened yesterday news is just lost in the digital din, and we can pretend otherwise, but everything we know about our business and where it's headed is that we've got to do more than that. And under Karen Magnuson's leadership, who was editor when Time to Educate began last year, and certainly now, and Julie has been central to this, and Justin's and Erica's efforts, and many other people, we're out there really focusing on this. And my mind is worrying listening to this discussion about different coverage avenues we can go down to build in year two, year three, year four, just as Rochester's progress is going to be years in the making, right? It has been, it will be. Same for what we do. And a great city needs a great newspaper, and that's going to be us.
Well, let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back, and we're going to talk to our colleagues from the Democrat and Chronicle more about the specific issues of coverage in Rochester schools. We're going to talk about what's going on at East, whether that model can travel, what we're learning, and what Justin in particular has been reporting on recently there. And we'll take some of your feedback. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. It's just a small subject, how to fix schools. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. I'm Evan Dawson, Monday on The Next Connections. We often hear that some of the top minds at Kodak, the scientists, the patent holders, that they have moved into the new Rochester economy, technology, information, photonics maybe, but has it really happened? We'll meet some of them. We'll talk about making that transition Monday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So as we look at what's happening in Rochester schools, there's a lot of focus on East. What's going on at East High? There's been a partnership there with the University of Rochester. How long has it been now, Justin Murphy?
We're finishing the fourth school year.
Okay. And let's talk a little bit about some of the results we've seen and what's happening next at East, because I think this is instructive. Whether it's the school board president, Van White, who touts it a lot as, you know, at least one data point that shows the kind of progress that might not only indicate that some things are happening, but also that might be able to be deployed elsewhere. What's going on there? Take us through your reporting recently.
Yeah, so this is the keystone, I would say, of the argument that we're on a slow and steady trajectory upward, and we need to maintain some stability in that. In the 4 years that East has been there, it has gone from maybe the worst high school in the city, at least in the conversation, to actually one of the most requested by parents. They are anticipating a graduation rate in June north of 60%, and another, I don't know, maybe 65% in August. And they just had their a new contract extension signed with the University of Rochester, so that very fruitful partnership will continue. The critics of East point out that now, compared to when the program began, there are fewer students with disabilities, particularly the more intensive disabilities, fewer, I think, English language learners, and fewer students altogether. If I recall correctly, it went from about 1,600 to maybe it's around 10,050 or something like that right now. So they would say, well, yeah, it's easy to improve your school when you kick out all the kids with disabilities who are dragging you down. I don't think that's fair. They still have a plenty challenged student body to deal with. The other big benefit they've gotten is much more per pupil aid there. A report came out a while ago, and East didn't agree with all of the particulars of it, but it said roughly most RCSD high schools get around $22,000, I think, per pupil, and East gets about $36,000. And when people, I think, you know, people say you throw money at a problem in kind of a derogatory way, but of course the money pays for important things. So what that means at East is many more social workers, more teachers, especially reading specialists and that sort of thing, more administrators to kind of keep everything moving smoothly. So, you know, let's be optimistic and say that they've been picking up, I don't know, 5-10 percentage points on their graduation rate every year. So let's think that in another 5 years they're at 85% and suspensions remain down and it's more or less a high functioning school. I think the implication of what that means is bracing, because what we're learning there is if you support kids to the tune of twice as much as we are now, or almost that much, and if you have student bodies that are, even while still very poor and very disadvantaged in some ways, not impossibly so, then you can have a high-functioning urban school. The problem is that with the demographics of Rochester, we can't do that. So it turns out that a lot of the kids who are not at East anymore are at Edison now, and Edison is having extraordinary problems. There's always been a phenomenon in the city where there's one or two schools that are kind of the place of last resort, where if your parents didn't sign you up somewhere else, you'll go there. For a long time, it was Charlotte, and Charlotte closed. For a long time, it was East, and East is with the U of R now. And at the moment, I think it's Edison is kind of like that, that if kids don't go anywhere else, they go to Edison, even if they're not necessarily interested in what's going on there. So that kind of gets to the question of improvement on a school level versus on a district level.
Which, I have to tread carefully here because I know how sensitive this is, but this is very similar to the kind of questions that come up when we talk charter schools. I'm not saying the East is a charter school, but...
Yeah, that's right. It is.
Right?
Yeah. There's always, the interim superintendent, Dan Lohengard, says this very often when people, for community schools, for instance, if... Say we have a very ambitious plan, and out of the 52 school buildings in Rochester, we convert half of them immediately to community schools. Whatever the most optimistic interpretation of that possible, that still leaves half of the kids not in what you think is the best thing. And so the improving individual schools kind of turns into a confidence game where you're, you know, one comes out of receivership and don't look at this other one, and then, you know, we put our resources there, like Julie said, and because, you know, it's not, RCSD doesn't pull summer programs and librarians and whatever else because they're stupid or full of malice. They understand the consequences of that, but it costs a lot of money to run a school with overwhelmingly poor students, many of whom have disabilities or don't speak English, and almost all of whom have faced some trauma in their lives. It's an expensive thing to do.
And so I guess you can deflect on this if you don't want to put on an analyst cap, but I will at least ask, when you've got East, and this is not to disrespect the work they've done, whether it's Dr. Nelms or so many of the other people there who have clearly worked very hard, but when you've got a school that has 65% more funding per pupil, it sounds like, roughly, than other schools, something like that. And time emphasis from a partnership with the U of R, I know it's a little murky on exactly what their numbers in terms of overall student body, children with disabilities, et cetera, but, you know, there may be at least some questions there. Have we learned enough that anything can be applied elsewhere?
Well, yeah, there certainly are some things that they have put together a really nice curriculum that's being shared with the district. I think that there's important teaching practices that they have together. But, you know, so to get back to the kind of question of, like, is this good news or did East cheat? I think that one really important takeaway here is that the brightest education minds that we have in the Rochester area, at the University of Rochester, an enormous amount of studying and research went into this. And what they determined is we can get student achievement up, not perfect, but up with a lot more money, which means a lot more social workers and teachers and whatever else, and with a more controlled level of the problems that are just extremely difficult to get to as a school. So we all, like the rest of us in the United States, need to think about, are we committed to following that plan? If that's the plan, is that something we can do? Which, you know, people say, oh, it's $1 billion. So $1 billion sounds like a lot until you're running a school for 25,000 kids, 23,000 of whom are, you know, eligible for free lunch.
Let me get some listener feedback now for our panel here. And I'll start with a question that goes right on the backs of what Justin's talking about with East when it comes to the curriculum, developing the curriculum. Amy says, do the conversations about what might help our schools include critical examination of curricula and pedagogy? And if so, who participates in those conversations and how can community members contribute or participate? That curriculum question's an important one, isn't it?
Yeah. So to get down from this like 30,000 foot level we're talking about, that is a key takeaway from the Distinguished Educator. It's an obvious point. All of the 52 schools in RCSD, there's probably 30 different sets of curriculum. It's a ridiculous system, especially given that kids move from school to school so often. So that is a like strictly localized within RCSD piece of low-hanging fruit. Get a common curriculum for elementary and secondary. That's something they're working on. I think that is an area where we should expect promising results in the next couple years.
Okay. So let's kind of get a little bit more feedback from listeners who I think have a wide range of sort of either concerns or questions. And this is one that stood out to me when I was having a conversation with some of the candidates for school board, including a candidate who is a teacher who is running, who, you know, said that her preference is to see a countywide school district. Well, here's Diana who says, I'm sorry, this is Diane says, I really respect Erica Bryant's knowledge and columns over the years. She has a great handle on education in Rochester. By the way, this didn't come from you with a different account, I don't think. It's actually
her
just,
mom.
Just,
I'm over here with my phone sending emails.
It's just Diane.
Myself.
So Diane goes on to say, since concentration of poverty is the root cause, why wouldn't restructuring the countywide school district resolve most of the problems? Well, I'm going to let all of our guests weigh in if they want to on that. But here's, Julie, here's where my mind goes on this. This is a time where we're talking about a state takeover of the school board. That's pretty radical, right? I mean, we can at least agree that that is a dramatic step.
Right.
And if we're willing to at least talk about that, everything should be on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that there's not the political will for a countywide school district. I am very well aware that when you go out, for example, and this is not to sort of to unfairly sort of pick at, but just go out to members. What happened in Spencerport when they talked to urban suburban? I mean, we're talking what, 24 kids a year, and the community. I mean, it was those meetings were absurd is a word that comes to mind, and I don't wish to editorialize too much here, but I get that there's going to it'd be hard to have political will, but if we are going radical now, shouldn't everything be on the table? Well,
even
the candidates for school board to tell me, yeah, we should go to countywide schools, say, never happen. It'll never happen. It'll never happen. Diane says, why not?
Well, we agree. We have editorialized that everything should be on the table, and we've asked Monroe County Executive Cheryl DeNoffel to become more involved, and she is becoming more involved. So if you don't have those conversations, then no, it will never happen. It will never happen. It will never happen. But if this community can finally stop looking at it as it has to be this solution, I'm not going to look at any other solution, which is what we've been doing. We're very siloed. We all believe we have the answer. Instead of listening and taking pieces from everybody's answer and finding something that works for Rochester that will go through. So it's having those conversations and not removing anything from the table is very important.
Erica, is there any political will for this right now?
Man, I think I believe that I think there's no political will because people are scared. People think, look back at Mayor Johnson's effort to create a countywide school district that would be split four ways, sort of draw across down the, you know, divide Rochester into four, and then there would have been four different districts. And he lost the county executive election, and since then politicians have been scared to touch it. But I mean, that is the solution that would work, and it's pretty much everybody you talk to will say that, and data shows and everyone knows that deconcentrating poverty is what will work. And as far as the way of getting to that solution in Rochester, I do not know. I don't know the answer to that. But I think it's worth saying and worth us knowing that Rochester is unique in its ability to segregate its poorest and most needy students. It is not like this all over the country. It is not. New York is the worst, the most segregated state in terms of schools. And Rochester is, we're almost the worst of the worst in the state. I would almost say that we are the worst in the state. I'm not positive of that, but I would bet money that we are. Because I don't know how we do it. Mathematically, it's difficult to do what we've done. Like, to have a school district that's so concentrates, has such high concentrations of poverty, and we have to deal with that. I think that we have to deal with that. I would like the state to, you know, create some mechanism or somebody to sort of take the lead and say we cannot have such high concentration of poverty in our schools, because, you know, it's just so difficult to create situations in which high concentrated poverty schools can create environments which kids can thrive. And if we are not going to do that, then we got to spend 50 or however, what did Justin say? It was 36,000.
Yeah.
So if we want to keep all of the poorest and most needy kids segregated into these schools, knowing that what is going to happen, then we should just spend the $36,000 a year for each kid so that they can have a shot at a better education.
Thank you for that email. Let's go to Doug writes to us to say, can you ask about the success of World of Inquiry? It seems they have a pretty high academic performance. What are the major differences there versus other schools?
I'd say the two major differences there is first of all, the poverty. It's not as poor of a school. It's highly, the students, that is, and is highly selected by the middle-class families in the city. And the other one, which is another problem that has really plagued Rochester forever, is stability. It has a lot of teachers who have been there for a long time. It has a lot of people who really buy into the program there. You know, that is something that the distinguished educator pointed out that hasn't gotten as much attention, which is that not only at the superintendent level, but when every superintendent comes in and brings in a new set of deputies and a new set of chiefs, and the principals rotate in and out of buildings, it's impossible to maintain any kind of working relationships or momentum toward a shared goal. So I think that those are two important things that World of Inquiry has.
And on the subject of turnover, Alex number two emails to say, one of the recurring criticisms of the district has been turnover in administrative staff and seemingly annual changes announced from the top down. Are there any worthwhile plans to change the district from the bottom up? Many community schools, such as School 22 and School 9, have a great network of educators and support staff and work very well in their own buildings. Should we be reducing managerial bloat and instead allocate more money to each individual school? How do we evaluate that? How does that conversation start?
Well, there's mechanisms in place for that. The district for a number of years, you know, that was one of Barbara Dean Williams' main pushes, was she often said, we want central office to be a service provider and for the actual work and the innovation to be happening at school levels. There are something called school-based planning teams, which in theory are a vehicle for a lot of that innovation. Practically speaking, they get criticized because teachers have kind of an outsized influence. But again, because there's a lot of transience among students in Rochester going from school to school, because all the other systems in the city are on a citywide basis, it's hard to take more than 50 schools and institute something resembling coherent educational reform. For one thing, that means 50 like extraordinary principals, which we usually don't have at any given time.
Right. And if you think of the effect of receivership, the opening and closing of schools, they're required to replace their staff. And so they, if they're not, you know, I don't remember the exact percentage, but there's a lot of turnover, just the opening and closing of schools that we do, which is state required by the state.
Well, I think, you know, a really important connecting line through a lot of these things that we're talking about, the political pressure builds up. And so, like, in the school board, every single candidate for school board in the last 30 years has run on the same topic. The district's doing terrible. The board's not in there talking to parents, doing a good enough job. Get some fresh blood in, let somebody else have a shot in it. It's, you know, the stump speeches write themselves at this point. There are a certain number of things that you can do more or less painlessly. The main one within the school district is to fire the superintendent. But you don't have to wait 4 years for an election. You don't have to negotiate with the union. You can say, this guy's not cutting it, this lady's not cutting it, we'll get somebody else. Going back to the earlier conversation about countywide schools, a lot of the reasons that there's kind of a repetitious playbook in terms of school reform, when you think about, there's charter schools, there's a state takeover, there's some sort of mayoral control, there's not a lot other than that, because those are the things that we can say, if this works, then I, you know, white person in the suburbs, for instance, don't have to do anything, right? If charter schools fix urban education, then my hands are clean. All this other stuff that is considering the Rochester community as a community rather than 18 towns or whatever surrounding a city,
it gets
a lot messier very quickly for people.
Absolutely. And that's where I think it is so connected to Erica's point about how segregated we are. And then, you know, sort of who's culpable? What stitches together to create this kind of a scenario that is very hard to get out of? But Justin's right. I mean, that's Hanauer's point in the Atlantic Monthly this month. It's a nice bedtime story you can tell yourself at night when you're, you know, sort of a wealthy person with a lot of power in this country, that, well, hey, this one school fixed a problem in one neighborhood, so just do that everywhere. As opposed to, wow, economically, we may have a system that creates massive inequality that may not fix it. Go ahead.
I have a correction here from Sean Nelms, who is feverishly texting me. He says, the number is closer to 27,000, not 36,000. 36,000 was never intended to be a per-pupil cost. It was a projected cost based on incomplete data. RCSD has since clarified this. I think the point stands, which is that one of the reasons that East is successful is that it has provided more services via employees to its students. And I don't think that should be a point against East, that you know, they're doing some kind of Scrooge McDuck thing, swimming in money. They're using the money for things that are proven to help students. But anyway, he says 27, not 36. And Sean, not always, but sometimes, knows what he's talking about.
He's gonna have a text for you for that comment. Dr. Nelms, if you are listening, by the way, and apparently you are, and it's great that you are, let's have a conversation with you and various people from East to talk about the plan going forward now, because it's important that the community understands this. It's important that we understand in depth, not just sort of a passing glance, what's happening there and how it may or may not be applied elsewhere. And in our last couple of minutes, I will say, Julie, you know, my colleagues, James Brown, Tim Macaluso, had a really interesting conversation with the incoming superintendent. And I'm trying to get inside the head of somebody who is coming from the Washington area, coming up to Rochester. Now there may be a state takeover of the school board. You might feel somewhat undercut about what power you'll have. He's trying to understand everything that's happening here. Starts technically next month. I'm sure the work has already started. He was pretty good at not saying much while saying a lot of words, because you have to do that in that spot, because it's early. You know, it's early, but he wants to be careful. But I think he's in a very hard spot. And I want to know what we should expect of a new superintendent, another new superintendent, given all this uncertainty.
Well, I don't think he's in any harder of a spot than anyone that preceded him. It's a tough spot to be in, and he's a brave soul is all I have to say for that. And I hope people treat him kindly, give him a warm welcome. When we get back to looking at communities that are making progress, urban communities that are comparable to Rochester. Public Policy Institute, the Farish Foundation, and the Chamber of Commerce brought them in recently. And the communities that are showing progress are all doing something different, and none of them are exactly one of those things from the playbook. They are all unique to their own communities. They're things that aren't black and white, standardized solutions. They're things that have been worked out. They have people who took leadership positions. They had in-depth conversations. They let parents lead the way out. And they're coming up with some things that are really showing progress. Is everything fixed yet? No. But they're showing a heck of a lot more progress than we are.
Well, we're down to our last minute. Time to Educate moves into its second year. What do you want from readers and the public?
To be as informed as possible. Immediately, there's going to be a lot of information coming from all sides. This is turning into a political issue, not an educational issue, because of everything that's going on.
Is that a problem?
It is a problem, because there's going to be a lot of misleading information out there. So I think it's really important for the community to come together, make sure they're getting accurate information, have conversations, don't pick sides, just try to understand and listen to all sides. And that's how we're going to move forward.
Well, I want to thank our guests for being here. And that's Julie Phillip, who's the Senior Engagement Editor for the Democrat and Chronicle, and Michael Killian, Executive Editor for the Democrat and Chronicle. I hope we have a lot of conversations going forward because, you know, hey, we're linked up with City now, but I want all print in this city to thrive. It is only good for this country when you are thriving, when City is thriving, when alt weeklies do well, when daily print does well. I am an unabashed supporter of great journalism in this country. I don't want to be a part of a country that doesn't have it. Thank you for being here. Let's talk more.
Yes, thank you.
Our thanks as well to Justin Murphy and Erica Bryant from the Democrat and the Chronicle. Thanks for the work you're doing. We appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And our thanks to Dolores, who's volunteering for us today, Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great weekend, as always, and we'll talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.